As the manpower needs in Vietnam have grown larger, the government has progressively limited the numbers who are exempted from military service. Some months ago, Washington announced that the blanket deferment of graduate students would be ended. And then a federally appointed commission suggested that this exemption be continued for students in engineering, in health, in science, and in mathematics. Presumably, the nation has greater need for men who can build the missiles, perform the complicated equations which track the missiles on their way and sew up again the bodies which have been shattered by their burst, than it does for infantrymen in Southeast Asia. Now, by implication, these men are essential to our security, and men who are preparing themselves in other fields, the philosophers, the classicists, the humanists, the historians, are not so urgently needed that their education cannot be interrupted. We have seen in the last 20, 30 years or so a constant upgrading of the pure sciences, of technology, and these disciplines, and a consistent erosion of the standing and of the importance attached to the social sciences, and even more so to the liberal arts. There is a National Science Foundation. There is no National Foundation for the Humanities. In many universities, there is one pay scale for the men in pure science and quite another for men in philosophy or in classics. It is as if we were saying to ourselves, we need men who can build, men who can engineer, men who can create for us the complex, intricate urban life which is ours, but we are not for the moment that concerned with the quality of that life. It's aesthetics, it's beauty, what is required of us, the values by which we may live. I can imagine, for instance, this commission saying to itself, well, the past can stay buried. What we don't know yet about the past, we do not obviously need that urgently to know. So these men can be taken from their desks and from their books and put to other use. And our first inclination is to agree. But I wonder because I look about me and I see the Negro minority in the United States desperately looking about to create its own history, to recreate a past which had been erased and lost. Apparently, unless a group is proud of its background, it feels the rootage which history alone permits it, it cannot find something of pride and dignity which it requires for balance. But beyond this, though all of us will agree that theses tend to be very narrow, and though we may agree that the world can do without for another year or two another avalanche of papers or on this or that byway of world history, I wonder if we have recognized that these papers are, after all, no more than the bones on which neophyte historians sharpen their teeth, on which they learn the subject matter, manipulating which they learn the art, the perspective which is uniquely that of the historian. For it is the historian's task to look behind. He will not accept the surface meeting, the immediate justification, the superficial explanation. He knows that all life is ambiguous, that every history is a complex of a variety of causes, social and religious and political and personal and idiosyncratic. And he knows that there are no neat explanations. And so he knows, as he knew 8 and 10 years ago, many of these historians knew, that the very simple, neat explanations of our involvement in Vietnam were far too pat to explain and to justify. And these men were, interestingly, among the first to raise the flag of caution. And it is this cast of mind which I submit is increasingly important to a nation, which tends to look to simple answers or to changes of personal leadership for the solution to complex problems. I am, by graduate training, an historian. And as a rabbi, I draw the subject matter of my history, of course, from our Jewish field. And I'd like to illustrate for you this morning this historian's cast of mind by taking as my text a place many of you have seen, perhaps, God willing, all of you will see, the great tabletop fortress of Matsada in Israel. It's a magnificently thrilling sight. You stand on the valley of the Dead Sea Depression, and above you there towers 2,000 feet of sheer rock cliff, nature at its most primitive and its most powerful. And from the top, you can cast your eye to 360 degrees of the horizon. To the west, you will see the desolation of the Judean hills. To the north and to the east, you will see the depression, the silence, the heat of the Dead Sea. To the south, you will see the continuing emptiness of the Wadi Aqaba. You have the sense that you are seeing the world as it was before the children of men entered upon it. And on the top, on the 2+ acres of the tabletop of this rock fortress, once you have managed the serpentine climb up the sheer face of the hill, you will find many of the most magnificent of the ruins of a land that is filled with ruins. For in the last decades of the last pre-Christian century, the Idumean king of the Judeans, Herod, built on this tabletop, on this fortress, a citadel. And he filled it with palaces and storerooms and cisterns and barracks rooms and an arsenal. And on the north face of the cliff, he hung down a 3-tiered palace villa. His Judean architects rivaled the imagination and the skill of a Frank Lloyd Wright. These 3 tiers hang down in the coolest part of the mountaintop, and their balustrades and their balconies and its porches and columns and baths and private rooms are among the most magnificent that man can imagine. The beauty of the surroundings, the extent of the ruins, have drawn to Matsada men and women, tourists, historians from all over the world. But the Jewish heart has particularly been impressed by the history implicit in this citadel. In the debris that was found on the 2nd tier down of the palace villa of King Herod, the archaeologists uncovered 3 skeletons. The skeleton of a young man in his early 20s, of a young woman, apparently his wife, and of a child. And near them they found her braids, the child's sandals, the link chain of the man's armors, household equipment. These 3 were among the 960 men, women, and children who held out on Matsada's top for 7 years between the years 65 of the Common Era and 73. Years of Judean rebellion against the Iron Boot of Rome. And if you look down from the mountaintop, you will see on the floor of the Dead Sea Valley the neat square legion camps, 7 of them. 10,000 Roman legionnaires encamped against this fortress. And all around the floor of the valley, around this great forest fortress citadel, you will see a circumferential wall built there by the auxiliaries of the Roman legionaries. The historian Josephus tells us that 10,000 military captives were used by the Roman commander to build this wall and to build high the great heap of debris and of stone raised against the west wall, which was raised high by the Roman general in order to surmount it by a shielded tower 4 stories high,
on which he
hung the great battering ram, whose iron-headed log ultimately breached the walls of the fortress. You see, as it in your eyes, not only in your mind's eye, but you actually see the Roman camp. You see the way the Romans took up to this citadel. You see the place where the skeletons were found, and history comes alive. A history which is uniquely important to this generation. For Israel is the symbol that the Jewish people no longer will sit patiently awaiting some messianic freedom. We are thirsty for freedom and will demand it now. And Matzadah is the statement that in our past our people struck out and demanded their freedom. And not surprisingly, the army in Israel uses Matzadah for many of its breveting ceremonies. At night, the new young officers are brought to the top of Matzadah, and they light their torches, lighting them symbolically from the bravery and the courage of their ancestors. They must then carry on with this tradition in their military lives. Matzadah speaks to the Jewish soul. It's, in a sense, a sermon in stone. A very impressive place. Now, one would be tempted to leave Matzadah alone. It speaks its own words, effectively, emphatically. But an historian cannot. And so one of the great soldiers of Israel, who happens also to be an archaeologist, Yigael Yadin, some years ago began the extensive excavation and ultimately the rehabilitation of Matzadah. He could not leave Matzadah in its ruin, in its simplicity. The historian must know, even though there is danger that in his knowledge he will smudge or blur something of the effectiveness of the sermon. And he found many things on Matzadah. He found a new sermon. As he uncovered the great palaces, there are several on Matzadah's top, as he uncovered the lavish quarters of the generals of Herod's army, he recognized that those who had 80 years later defended Matzadah's top had eschewed these luxurious places. And instead, they had built their humble dwellings in the casement wall, the perimeter wall around the top. Matzadah is defended in the first instance by a double wall, which runs along the edge of the cliff, 360 degrees. And inside that wall, Herod had built the barracks rooms and the storerooms and the arsenals for his troops. But when the defenders of Matzadah came there in the year 65, they didn't build their homes and their in the palaces. They went to this casement wall, and they made the rooms even smaller. And here they built a dormitory, and here was a schoolroom for their children, and here was a place where they washed their clothes, and here were the ovens where they cooked their food. Herod was rich, and Herod was a master builder, and Herod had the great palaces. But Herod, interestingly, was not a free man. Herod built Matzadah because he feared for his life. He was a puppet of Rome. He feared that in the complex of international policy, Rome would give over his dominion to Cleopatra or to another. He built Matzadah so he would have a place to defend himself if that untoward event came to place. And these, the last defenders of Matzadah, were poor, and they were not master builders, but unlike Herod, they were free. And they did not need, because they had their freedom, to live in sumptuous surroundings. Freedom surrounded them and encouraged their lives. Yadin found other things. He found that in the casement walls these people had built for themselves in one room slightly larger than the rest, what was apparently a synagogue. They had taken an assembly room, put four tiers of benches around its walls, and it was here that they read aloud again and again to one another the Torah, where God proclaims freedom unto the land. And in the wall, in the floor of that room, his spades and the spades of those who worked with him came across ancient scrolls, part of the book of Deuteronomy, part of the prophecy of Ezekiel, buried there by pious men and women who had come to Matsada to defend what could be defended of the Judean existence. He found in another part of the casement dwellings another scroll, Hebrew scroll of the wisdom of Ben Sirach. This book was written by a Jerusalem merchant as a literary testament to his son some two centuries before the Common Era. It's a book very much like the book of Proverbs in our Bible, and this particular scroll is important to us because until modern times we had only Greek translations of the original, and this scroll is in the original Hebrew. We are closer now to the text. But one, an historian, knows they will come across things which blur and make difficult the simple reconstructions of a place. In another casement room, he came across another scroll. This scroll was a strange one. It was a collection of hymns to be sung to accompany the Sabbath sacrifice. And what is strange about this scroll is that in its basic calendar, in terms of the chronology on which it is based, in terms of the philosophy about predestination, which its poems and hymns teach, in terms of the language, the idiom which it uses, it is near to identical to one found in the cave some 30 miles up the Dead Sea above Qumran, found among the literary remains of the Dead Sea Covenant people. And so the question comes into being. Who were the defenders of Matsada? Yadin believes that these defenders were the zealots, the most militant, the most liberty-loving, the most determined of the Pharisees who fought against Rome during this first century. But here we have a sectarian scroll. Were the Dead Sea Covenant sectarians the defenders of Matsada? If so, it would be strange indeed, for we know that these people tended to be pacifists. Perhaps we have here an indication that pacifism itself is a relative virtue if the very survival of the people of the nation is at stake. Or else, that scroll may simply have found its way here in the knapsack of one who wandered down along the shore of the Dead Sea until he came to Matsada, who found this scroll and brought it with him, or by a lone survivor of this Dead Sea community, which itself was reduced by the Romans. We simply do not know. But the innocence of the history, its straightforwardness, its neatness has been ruptured. And the question has been raised, who were the last defenders of Matsada? Yadin believes that they were the zealots. We know a good deal about the zealots. They first began to rebel against Rome in the year 4 of the Common Era. They were in constant state of revolt for some 50 years. They resented Roman tyranny, Roman taxes, Roman domination, Roman perversion of the worship in the temple. And they disappear from history after the defeat of 70. After the destruction of the temple, most of them were taken captives and brought as slaves to Rome. A close reading of Josephus, the historian of this period, by the man who is the greatest historian alive of the Judean kingdom of the Second Commonwealth, Solomon Zeitlin, has led him to question the identity of the defenders of Matsada. He disagrees with Yadin. He does not believe that these defenders were the zealots, nor does he believe that they were the Dead Sea Covenant people. He believes that they were a strange group of Judeans who were professional anarchists and professional assassins. They're called the Sicarii. The word Sicarii is a Latin word which describes a small dagger, a kind of dagger which could be hidden up the sleeve of a toga. These men were not unlike the professional anarchists who abounded in Russia in the last days of the Tsar. Men who used their Greek Orthodox faith to say that only God may rule over man, no man may rule over another, and they went about Russia sowing turmoil by assassinating a count here, a government official there. And so it was in first century Judea. These Sicarii were opposed to all dominion save the dominion of God alone. They took literally the text of 1 Samuel, in which Samuel berates the Jews for demanding a king and says, only God shall be your ruler. And so in the days of when the Jewish community was being driven underground and destroyed by the Roman might, these people went out not only attacking Rome, but attacking the high priest and the Hasmoneans and the Judean generals and all who had authority over another. Now, Zeitlin's argument rests on several interesting facts in the text of Josephus. He notes that whoever came to Matsada came there in the year 65 and remained there until the year 73, and not once is it told that the defenders of this fortress went out to ambush a Roman garrison, to plunder a Roman camp, to sow confusion in the Roman ranks. We know that the Zealots who defended other fortresses, Jotapata, Herodion, Machaerus, constantly were bees who flew out against the Roman army and did what damage they could, but not the defenders of Matsada. Josephus tells us that the defenders of Matsada, on the other hand, often attacked Jewish settlements. About 10 miles up the Dead Sea coast from Matsada, there's the community of Ein Gedi, a beautiful oasis, rising in the middle of this wilderness. But we know that the defenders of Matsada attacked Ein Gedi and carried off slaves and carried off plunder, even though it was a Judean settlement. And he bases himself also on Josephus's reconstruction of the last speech of Eliezer, the general of Matsada, as he encourages his men to accept the compact of suicide by which these people died. For they did not defend themselves to the last. Rather, once the wall had been breached and they knew that the next morning the Romans would be through the wall, they chose lots. And each man whose lot was chosen slew 10 of those who remained. And then in turn they chose lots until only a few remained. They committed suicide. And Josephus has put into the mouth of Eliezer the call of his rallying call to this compact of death. And in it, again and again, Eliezer insists that man must be free, and the soul which is not free is worse than a slave. It has bought for itself a living death. Far better that we die as free men than we would be enslaved by any man. Zeitlin argues now that these men, these Sicarii, early on in the war, came down to Matsada, remained there quietly during the entire revolt, hoping to build there their own community, to be forgotten about. If the Romans could delay it 3 years after the end of the war, reducing Matsada, because these men were no danger to them, they were simply a group of assassins who had withdrawn, as it were, from the world, professional anarchists, and that ultimately, when they began to attack neighboring settlements, Rome had to come against them and finally did reduce the fortress. Matsada then would be a shrine not only to Judean courage, but Matsada, if this reconstruction be true, is a shrine to the folly of men who are seized by a single-minded ideal, who are fanatics with one value and one value only, and who find reason, as men occasionally do, to violate every decency and every ethical principle on the argument that the means justify the ends. Now, Zeitlin has not fully proven his case. Yadin has not fully proven his case. The mystery of Matsada remains. But I think I've said, told you enough about Matsada to show you how historians must go about their work. To illustrate the skeptical mind, the mind which reveres facts and seeks to understand them, their quality and their meaning, the mind which cannot be satisfied with superficiality, with simplicity, the mind which knows that the domino theory or containment or speech about the importance of living up to one's pledged word is too simplistic and too superficial. I've said enough, I believe, to illustrate the point that this nation has need not only of the builders of machines, and the engineers of speed, and the technicians of defense, but that it has need of men and women whose minds are trained to the ambiguity of events. Men and women who can sound out for us time and again warning signals that things are not as clean, clear, direct and simple as they seem to be. That this nation has need of trained minds of many stamps and of many kinds. And that perhaps it is time, as we see again in outline the values, the relative values we place on different disciplines, that perhaps it's time again for this nation to take stock of these values and to question whether or not we have not vested too much power and too much importance in one discipline at the expense of others, which alone can give us the balance and the perspective and the political understanding which are so desperately required. Amen.